Hey everyone, this is Tom Salemi of Device Talks. Welcome back to the Device Talks weekly podcast. Thank you very much to our friends at Freudenberg Medical for sponsoring this episode. We're going to be talking later on with Dr. Janar Sathananen. He is the Chief Medical Officer of Boston Scientific's Interventional Cardiology Therapy Group. And we'll talk about all things related to that. Of course, coronary artery disease, stents, and of drug-coated balloons, which is an interesting area that I've heard a bit about, but learned a lot about, and I'm sure you will too. Before that, Chris Newmark and I will talk with Sean Hooley about a few things. We'll cover probably the biggest story in medtech this week. Then Sean will talk about his visit to the American Diabetes Association annual meeting. I'll talk SRS, and we'll cover a few other important medtech topics. So I know you'll enjoy that. A few housekeeping things. So we'll put out a podcast next week. I think we'll put it out before July 4th. So you folks will have it to listen to. It's a conversation I had with Joe Mullings of the Mullings Group and Steve Bell, who was on the podcast a couple of weeks ago. We spoke at the SRS annual meeting. We spoke on the Saturday. The conference started on Thursday. So it's a bit of a wrap-up discussion. Joe and Steve have a lot of thoughts and opinions on the space, and they are not afraid to share them. It's great to talk to them. So that'll be our podcast next week. It's a good, robust one. So if you're driving to some lovely destination for the holiday, you'll be able to listen to that on your way there or on your way back. And other good news, we'll have Steve Bell as our next Device Talks Tuesdays guest. He'll speak on July 9th. He'll actually give the presentation that he delivered at SRS, which generated a lot of discussion and a lot of heat at the conference. So you should join us. You can listen to the presentation. I'll ask Steve questions, and you can ask Steve questions too. Just go to devicetalks.com and register for that. All right. Once again, thanks to Freudenberg Medical for sponsoring this episode of the Device Talks Weekly Podcast. Please remember that Device Talks West registration is open. I'm continuing to update the website with speakers. I can tell you we've got a few great keynotes lined up, including Adam Elsesser of Penumbra. I'll announce another one next week. And it's going to be a great few days, lots of robotics, lots of interventional talk, lots of neurotech talk. Please join us at Device Talks West on October 16th and 17th at Santa Clara Convention Center. All right, let's get this podcast started. All right, you ready for this?
Ready.
Chris Newmarker, how are you, sir?
Good, Tom. Good. Good to be here. Happy summer, man.
Happy summer. It's been a couple of weeks since we got you on here. It's been busy. You've been busy. I've been busy. We've been traveling. And our guest in the studio, Sean Hooley, has been busy as well. Sean Hooley, welcome back to the podcast. It's been a while for you as well.
It has. Thank you for having me back. Very pleased to be here.
You guys are both... both got your vitamin D down in Florida over the past week or so.
That's right. I was thinking, had we known we were both in Orlando at the same time, maybe we could have been roomies, or maybe we could have driven down. It could have been an adventure of hijinks.
Well, we could have at least sweated in the humidity together.
Yes, it was warm now, although I think it was warmer up in Boston. We're both up in Boston.
Miserable either way.
Yeah. No.
Is the heat wave over there now? Is it finally let up on you guys?
Yeah, the heat dome has lifted. Yes.
Yes. Yes. Good.
Yeah. No, we're very comfortable here in Boston. Anywho, we are going to do a little bit of newsmakers and a little bit of I guess what I did over summer vacation kind of stuff for both Sean and me, because we were both at conferences that we I think learned a lot from. But Chris, any big news this week that we want to cover?
Well, you know, the one thing that would be really good to cover is just really significant news in our industry is that the CFO of Medtronic is leaving.
Yeah, that was a surprise. Although I have to say, I recorded a podcast an interview with Joe Mullings, Joe Stradamus, as I like to jokingly call him,
Joe Stradamus,
yeah. And Steve Bell. at the Society of Robotic Surgery meeting that I was at last week, and we'll run that
It's
interview.
true. Joe says a lot of, I mean, you
And
know.
in that conversation last Saturday, to Joe's credit, he said, "You wait, Medtronic's going to have some big announcements coming up, something to that effect." So,
Yeah.
yeah, I think when a CFO goes, it's pretty big news, right?
Well, especially because I mean she was Karen Parkhill was CFO of Medtronic even before Martha rose up to become CEO of the
Oh, that's
company.
right. You're right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
Yeah.
right. I for some reason I had him bringing her on, but she was there. You're correct
There
with Omar.
before and
Yeah.
really played a important role like navigating Medtronic financially through the pandemic, through all the after effects of the pandemic, and on really some of like these major changes that we're seeing over at the world's largest medical device company right now. I mean, everything from moving around stuff in the portfolio, unfortunately layoffs, and many other things, also like trying to focus on R&D and innovation at the same time, to boost the company for the future. But she'll be moving along to become CFO of HP.
Yeah, no, and what was interesting, I thought I was trying to craft a LinkedIn post, and I hadn't really figured out what my theme was. But she came from, I believe, Comerica to Medtronic, so she was out of this was her only med tech post, I believe.
Yeah, she had a
Yeah,
financial background.
which is fine, but very
Oh, yeah.
typically, I was looking at, in preparation for my LinkedIn post, which I'm sure would have just brought down the internet, comparing other CFOs in the industry. They all have extensive experience, decades of experience, if not in med tech, at their specific company. So, Glenn Boehnlein of Stryker has been with Stryker for 21 years. Dan Brennan, CFO of Boston Scientific, has been there for 28 years. Phil Boudreau, CFO of Abbott, has been at Abbott 27 years. Christopher DelOrefice, if I'm saying his name correctly, I apologize. CFO at BD has been in the industry for 25 years at different companies. And Dwayne Van Arsdale, the CFO of Johnson & Johnson MedTech, which of course is a relatively new company, but Johnson & Johnson has been at J&J for 22 years. So,
While Parkhill, I mean Karen Parkhill, she spent nearly 20 years at J.P. Morgan Chase, so in
yep.
investment banking, commercial banking, then moving up to be a CFO at a Comerica Bank, so I mean very very much like a financial
Right.
background, which I mean
Which
it's
again, her leaving to join HP, I think for any other CFO, you'd be like, well, that's a really interesting move because as we've just outlined, most CFOs have a lot of have decades of experience in med tech.
Yeah, so why are you leaving MedTech?
But she is she's obviously had success inside and out. So yeah, interesting times for Medtronic.
It says something too. I mean, Sean wrote a really extensive article, that's on Mass Device that I, encourage anyone to read. One of the things we added in there was, if you look at HP's market cap. It's about a third of the size of Medtronic's, but I mean HP has been seeing, a lot of success and in recent years. I mean their stock's up 69% over the past 5 years. And I mean Medtronic, they've been grappling with a lot of changes with their healthcare customers, and trying to really prioritize what they're doing over there. And I mean their stock's down more than 18% over that same period. So I mean she's moving to a company that's been seeing a lot of
Yeah.
success.
Sean, you wrote an article. We should probably ask you about all this, huh?
I think
Yeah.
Chris covered it pretty in depth, to be honest. But yeah, no, obviously it came across the feeds bright and early yesterday, or it was just Wednesday of this week, and it was definitely took me by surprise, but I suppose, yeah, we're seeing sort of this grander. I think I saw someone comment on LinkedIn just one word, Exodus. So
Yeah.
it's an interesting time.
Yeah. I mean, maybe you could tell people a little more about that, Sean. I mean, there have been I mean, there have been a lot just in recent months. There have been a lot of, changes, going on in that C-suite over there.
Yeah, obviously, with some of the shifts, I suppose, in the business model and all that, there've been multiple changes. But the big thing that sort of triggered some departures was the shuttering of the ventilator business, and then the layoffs, and then you have looking at sort of just the recent list is just this month, Executive Vice President and Global Regions President Rob Ten Hoedt, retired or announced his
Yeah, he's
retirement.
retired. Yeah.
Two former Medtronic executives left for Endologics. Bonnie Handke, who was VP of Global Health Economics Policy and Reimbursement for Medtronic's Coronary and Renal Denervation, Peripheral Vascular Health, Structural Heart, Aortic, and Cardiac business, went to CVRx.
Yeah, and CVRx is grabbing a few Abbott executives as well, so.
Gio DiNapoli, a few months ago as well, was head of the GI business. He departed, although he's now at Cosmo Pharmaceuticals, which I believe works with Medtronic's GI business on that GI Genius. So, slightly different type of departure. And then again, Respiratory Interventions, Ariel McTavish left. Bob White departed as head of the medical surgical portfolio. So, yeah, it's been quite a few big names.
White's been a big fixture there over the years. I mean, that got a lot of attention when that news came out. So, yeah.
So yeah, I mean, clearly people leave companies and join other companies. But
Sure.
if you look at the numbers, there seem to be more than you would expect to see. We don't have data to support what is a lot and what is not a lot. But if you sort of just take a look, there certainly seems to be again a higher number of people taking positions at other companies. So we'll see where that goes.
I should say, because I do those personnel moves roundups at the end of every year, and sort of, and Medtronic is obviously just because of the amount that they bring in and the size of the company. There's always going to be departures, like you say, Tom. But yeah, it does seem a little bit more than normal.
And I think Gio DiNapoli, I think he said in his LinkedIn post that he was moving in, he's from Italy and wanted to move
Yeah,
back
he
to
won't.
Europe. So
Yeah. Yeah.
that certainly made some sense. So, all right, well, that was big news, and we'll certainly see how
We'll keep following it.
yeah,
Keep following what's going on.
who gets the gig. All right, so any other big news of the week, or should we just kind of go into our little what I did over our weekend in Orlando?
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, I'd say the, yeah, like just to lead into that, I mean, one of our really big stories on Mass Device was, or really stories, was, all this, great reporting we got from Sean out of the American Diabetes Association's scientific sessions in Orlando. I mean, Sean, what were the biggest things that really stuck out to you from from that event?
Yeah,
What was
well,
the vibe?
it was overwhelming for me because it was my first time there in person. It's a massive event. I don't know what the final tally was, but I think I heard someone say at least like 8,000 people. And people were saying that still hasn't returned to pre-COVID levels of attendance. So
So slightly bigger than Device Talks Boston.
only slightly,
Just
yes.
slightly, yeah. We'll get there.
Yeah, so, but it was massive. That convention center is massive, and it was just a lot of running around trying to figure out where I should be and when. But yeah, in terms of sort of the content coming out of it, obviously a lot of it was GLP-1 focused, which admittedly I didn't dive that deep into because it's not necessarily my area of expertise. Obviously, we're focused on devices more than anything, although there was a lot of talk of how the GLP-1s dovetail with devices. So CGMs, there's been a lot of data from Dexcom and Abbott about how the GLP-1s used with CGMs benefit everyone.
Yeah, that's, I mean,
ResMed
that's
as
it.
well. There's a presentation about GLP-1s and sleep apnea, so slightly separate from diabetes, but it happened. It was discussed there, so there's certainly still benefits with relation to the device world.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting because, yeah, I mean, a lot of company stocks took a hit, upon like kind of the success. A lot of med tech company stocks took a hit upon the success of GLP-1s, including like in the the questions in the diabetes space. Like, wow, if these drugs could really effectively treat diabetes, then you won't need as much diabetes treatment technology. But now there's some like really strong studies arguments coming from the co companies that like no, actually they work hand in hand. This could be an opportunity.
Yeah, there's certainly a lot of discussion over sort of the obviously there's different types of diabetes. There's people who are insulin intensive, people who are not, and there's all sorts of different people who need different things to manage their diabetes. So people who can take GLP-1s to manage their diabetes would still benefit from using CGMs or you know whatever devices to ensure that their glucose levels are in the right place. So that's obviously one big thing. Another thing is type 2 diabetes. It was sort of all the rage, and it was
Yeah.
convenient that I spoke with
Probably not the
someone.
rage. It wasn't like, yay, type 2 diabetes. You know
Yeah, I suppose I should work on my
what
phrasing there, but it was certainly a topic of conversation. And
Yeah.
Chris Scoggins from Abbott told me pretty it was my first meeting of the entire sessions, and he told me that I'm going to hear a lot about type 2, and he was absolutely right. Abbott and Dexcom are obviously pushing for type 2, the wider population, especially the population that doesn't use insulin, because that's their new over-the-counter CGMs are designed for that. And then Insulet was another company that has been presenting data on Omnipod 5 for the type 2 population, because right now it caters to the type 1 population, but they're showing benefits of automated insulin delivery in type 2. And that's something also that Embecta, while they don't have a commercial product for that yet, is also working towards. And they had a study highlighting how patch pumps work with type 2. So certainly the type 2 diabetes population seems like a priority. And it seemed
Yeah.
like sort of the center of the focus at ADA.
Just to back up a bit, I mean, up to this point, a lot of these really cool connected technologies that we've been that you've been writing about. I mean, the insulin pumps, the CGMs. I mean, they've been mostly focused on the type one population, and this is kind of like representing like a huge market expansion potentially for them, right? To
Yeah, I
go
think
in it
this.
to treat type 2 with these type of devices and other options.
Yeah, the CGM population for sure can extend to type 2 just because, you know, it all, I guess, depends on how they're
It's
managing
true.
their
Yeah.
insulin. But yeah, the insulin pumps for sure is an interesting sort of diversion. And then, yeah, just for people who aren't using insulin, so maybe don't feel the need to have a CGM or feel like they can, you know, just when they're feeling their blood sugars low, they can do the finger sticks or whatever, you know, glucose, you know, sort of outdated testing mode. The having the CGM, the over the counter that they can just go and,
Yeah.
if you know, or well, for right now, order through the company's channels, but you know, potentially down the line.
That's a really interesting trend that we're seeing these CGMs going over the counter that, basically if my doctor for, like not yet, but if I ever had a doctor telling me that I was having problems with regulating my blood sugar, I mean, that would it just be seems like a very easy thing to do, like, okay, the same way like I might be checking my blood pressure or my weight, I'm gonna go buy a CGM, like go check this out, try to get to the bottom of it.
I found it very interesting too, talking with Kevin Sayer from Dexcom. I asked if, you know, if basically at some point, not right now, I should stress, but maybe eventually, you know, you're walking into CVS to get, I don't know, a bag of Skittles or a birthday card or something, and you can walk by a CGM on a shelf, you know what I mean? And just buy
Yeah.
it there. And like I said, that's a ways away right now, because right now it's going through Dexcom's channels. But that just seemed it was interesting to me because we talk about all these heavily regulated devices, and CGMs up until now have been these heavily regulated devices that you're prescribed or these types of things, and now it's, you know, potentially, like I said, buying a bag of Skittles.
Or the Geek Squad from Best Buy might stop by and drop one off, or
Yeah.
something. Yeah, that'd be. And there and two, they're talking about other options too. I mean, the over-counter, the CGMs were interesting. I mean, it sounded like Embecta, the BD spinoff. They're working on, an insulin patch pump, and then they're excited about, kind of getting that to the type 2 population, right?
Right, yeah. So as I said, their study sort of showed that patch pumps can be effective in the type 2 population, and they're working on both an open loop, which is not automated, and a closed loop, which is an automated insulin pump. And the open loop one is closer. They've already submitted it to the FDA, I believe, if I'm remembering that correctly. So yeah, that's certainly something to watch. Obviously, Embecta has an established sort of foothold in the diabetes space, having been the BD. You know, they spun out from BD, and they were still the largest pure play diabetes company in the world. So they're
Yeah.
certainly already established, but they're looking to sort of grab some share in that insulin pump department. And obviously the underpenetrated type 2 population is, you can understand why they'd go in that direction.
Yeah, I mean, I was just, I just, went onto the, International Diabetes Federation's website really quick to look at their statistics. And I mean, they were saying there that over, you got a half a billion people worldwide, unfortunately, have diabetes, and, over 90% of them are type 2. So, I mean, this just, it sounds like there's just like a lot of excitement to like really expand like the technology available for this like huge chunk of people with diabetes.
Yeah, I mean, even Dexcom's estimate was that 25 million people are in the US right now with type 2 diabetes who don't use insulin but could still
Wow.
benefit from CGM use. So yeah, they're looking at 25 million new customers, and likewise for Abbott with its Libre Rio. But
yeah, that'll be exciting to watch. And then on the flip side, it seems, I mean, when we're talking about all this opportunity for Dexcom, like, we're talking here on a Thursday morning, and there's actually some news out about some layoffs from them.
It's I shouldn't not quite layoffs. It's an interesting sort of shift, but the company is changing its manufacturing site. So currently,
okay,
its manufacturing is all out of, or not all of it, but they have manufacturing out of San Diego. They're moving it out of San Diego. They're keeping their headquarters in San Diego and adding R&D capacity and moving manufacturing to Mesa, Arizona, where they can manufacture at scale, because obviously they're expecting heightened demand for the G7, which is still growing in popularity and adoption, and then the Stelo, which is coming soon in terms of a launch. So yeah, it was 536 jobs at the San Diego site were cut, but Dexcom did say that the company is going to have some opportunities for those employees to relocate if they wish to.
Okay.
And according to the San Diego Tribune report, the company also expects to add 400 more jobs in San Diego.
Wow.
As a result of this R&D shift. So yeah, it's weird. I don't know quite how you classify it in terms of job cuts, because they're, pretty much expecting to bring them all back, but
kind of a reshuffling. And I recall on our MedTech Big 100 report, Dexcom's always near the top when it comes to the percentage of their revenue that goes to R&D spending. So I mean, like, R&D just plays a huge role in that company.
Yeah, and they stress that the decision to stay obviously fully in San Diego is a commitment to the community, but also they recognize sort of the educational and research capabilities of the area with the University of California, San Diego, and the research labs there. So they're expecting to sort of bolster innovation by remaining there and adding R&D capacity while also, being able to scale in Arizona at the same time. So yeah, it's a weird mix of, you would think, sort of good news in the sense that they're adding a lot of capacity and ability, but obviously in the near term, 500 something jobs is never a good thing.
Overall, looks like the manufacturing is staying in the U.S. So, there we go. So it's good news for Arizona then. Very cool.
Well, Sean, you're clearly busy. I'm looking at the pages of Mass Device, and I see story after story. And of course, those are also published at Drug Delivery Business News. Is that where the full stories are posted, or are they on both sites?
That's right. The full stories are at Drug Delivery Business News, which has sort of turned into a, I would say, 95% diabetes hub over the past couple of years. But so even though CGMs don't deliver insulin, they still work in those combinations. So they fall under drug delivery in my categorization. But in any event, the stories are on Drug Delivery Business News, as well as one very large roundup that has all the stories that I was able to cover out there. A few studies, a few interviews, and all the things in between. So plenty of content to, spend your weekend looking through if that's what you like to do.
We'll take a quick break from this conversation to bring in our sponsor, Freudenberg Medical. I'm joined by Julia Calvet. She is Business Development Director of Drug and Devices at Hemotech, which is a company of Freudenberg Medical. Julia, welcome to the podcast. Tell us a bit about Freudenberg Medical.
Hi, thanks for the introduction. Freudenberg Medical is a global partner to medical device OEMs for product design, development, and manufacturing. We offer a broad range of vertically integrated solutions, from medical components and tubing to drug device solutions and finished devices. Altogether, we have 11 locations worldwide, all located in key medtech clusters in Europe, Americas, and Asia, and we have almost 3,000 employees. For the segment of minimally invasive devices, we design and manufacture complex catheter shafts, plug-and-play handle solutions, hemostasis valves, hypertubes, steerable solutions, complex extrusions, balloons, and drug device solutions. Hemotech, based in Germany, is part of Farnbeck Medical for the last 10 years.
That's great, Julia. And what is Hemotech? Tell me about that, please.
Hemotech is a leading contract development and manufacturing organization for drug device combination products, specialty coated medical devices and components. And it's a part of Farnbeck Medical. This year, Hemotech is celebrating its 25th anniversary. So we are very proud of our achievements with over 100 granted patents since our inception and a global customer base. Our team at Hemotech counts more than 300 members. A significant proportion of us being specialist engineers and scientists in the drug device field. So there is a lot of ongoing innovation across our team. We have partnered with our customers over the last 25 years to bring many pioneering clinical solutions to the patient.
And does Hemotech have any specialties?
Yes, we specialize in two areas. Firstly, drug device combination products such as drug-coated balloons and drug-eluted stents, with a particular expertise in paclitaxel and Lima solutions. And secondly, we also offer solutions for highly lubricious hydrophilic coatings on catheters and other minimally invasive devices. So when a medical device engineer thinks about how to apply a drug or functional coating to a minimally invasive device, with a number one phone call or email.
All right, well, thanks, Julia. We'll hear more from Freudenberg Medical a little later in the podcast. If you'd like to find out more information now, go to freudenbergmedical.com, and I'll spell Freudenberg for you, Freudenberg. So that's freudenbergmedical.com. Not to plug another podcast, but I don't know if anyone is listened to the Acquired podcast. I've just sort of stumbled upon it. But speaking of GLP-1s, they had an episode on Novo Nordisk and the creation of GLP-1s. And each podcast episode, they're 3 hours. They're almost audiobooks, but they're very well done. Folks should check it out. It was really, I've never really given Novo Nordisk that much consideration, but it was interesting to have someone do such a deep dive in a singular company that helped spearhead such a new and really potentially powerful new class of drugs. So folks should check out Acquired.
Very cool.
Cool. And while Sean was at that very massive convention center, you're right, I remember being down there once and just thinking how very, very large it was. I was at the Conrad Orlando, which is a swanky resort. I don't know if it's on the other side of Orlando, but it was not near the convention center. For the annual meeting of the Society of Robotic Surgery, it was about 1,700 people, so actually just slightly larger than Device Talks Boston. A great mix of industry and clinicians. Each panel had about three surgeons on it, and then 4 to 7 CEOs from surgical robotics companies exploring every different type of surgical robot out there. And really, really fantastic meeting. Really great to sort of hear from surgeons who are obviously fans of surgical robots, but to hear how they appreciate them as tools and how they use them and how they're excited about new versions coming out. And just a great meeting overall. We'll be, as I mentioned at the top, we'll be doing a recap of that with Joe Mullings and Steve Bell in our next episode of Device Talks Weekly. We'll put that out. We recorded it last Saturday. We'll put it out on Friday, July 5th. So this coming Friday. And, exciting times. I mean, there's a lot of, obviously, Intuitive was the sort of the bell of the ball. I bumped into Dave Rosa the morning of and saw him sort of standing there, and I kind of joked and looked at his back and said, do you literally have a target on your back, or do you just feel that way? And he confirmed that, yeah, they definitely feel like they're the big robot on campus. But there's a lot of interesting players out there. People were eager to see what Johnson & Johnson and Medtronic brought. Neither had a robot on site, which some found disappointing. Johnson & Johnson, of course, hasn't unveiled their robot, but they're still planning for an IDE in the fall. So a lot of questions there. But I think the real energy was around companies like SS Innovations, which is based in India. They had their Mantra 3. And if anyone wants to check out my LinkedIn feed, I did some video interviews with several surgical robotics companies and talked about their systems. Rob Surgical, which Todd Usen's involved in. He is the chairman and is from Spain. And it's a cool surgical robotic system that is actually laparoscopic agnostic. Lap agnostic. I was trying to come up with that term. They'll use Stryker. They'll use Olympus. You don't need to buy their scopes. So there's definitely a evolution of what surgical robotics are trying to do and trying to be. And it was very cool to be at that company at that conference. So, but you'll hear more about that next week.
You know, I think one of the trends you're seeing there was, I mean, we write about a lot about surgical robotic companies here in the U.S. and in Europe, but I mean, it sounds like there's a lot of really interesting stuff, you know, going on with companies from China and India. And it kind of sounds like we need to be paying more attention to that as well.
We definitely do. Steve Bell, who's kind of a surgical robotic expert in the industry, he opened up the session trying to alert people to all that's happening across the world. And even Tim Schmid, the head of Johnson & Johnson MedTech, who'd spent most of his career working OUS, made the point, like, look, folks, there's a lot of great stuff happening outside the U.S. where there's a lot of great engineers. There's less inertia. They're less encumbered by regulatory, and they're able to build robots quickly. I talked to SSI Innovations. They were founded in 2014. They came out with version 1 in 2018. They came out with Mantra 2 in 2020. I think I have it right. And now they're rolling out Mantra 3. And I spoke with Renovo. They have Karina, and they've come out with versions of that as well. So they're iterating, I think, a lot faster than US-based companies, and they're offering surgeons or offering hospitals surgical robotics at a lot less. I think SSI Innovations Mantra 3 is going for a third of the price of Intuitive. So, you know, they'll certainly apply pressure to Intuitive or any of the Medtronic or Johnson & Johnson when they try to build up their OUS businesses. They'll have to go up against some of these domestic players for the China market, for the Indian market, for Brazil. Brazil was talked about a lot as well. So interesting times.
For sure. Yeah, very interesting times. Yeah, we're going to be, watch out, because I think we'll be doing even more coverage of the surgical robotics space on Mass Device as well as with Device Talks programming. It's just such a dynamic, cool space right now.
Yeah, we'll have at Device Talks West, we'll have Noah Surgical, we'll have Virtual Incision. I believe we'll have Intuitive, and I'm trying to lock down a fourth, and we'll have Endiatics, Tori Smith's swallowable robot pill cam. He'll give a demonstration. He'll be our joint keynote with our co-located Robo Business Conference. So, yeah, it's hard.
I know you did a pepperectomy at a Device Talks Boston. Are you gonna navigate the fantastic journey through Tori's stomach in front of people? Or is he not gonna let you?
Swallow one, I would totally swallow one. But we'll see what happens. But,
oh boy!
Yeah, no, that's all. Say yeah. Who wouldn't be? I mean, come on. I assume it's Why not? For laughs and shtick and science, I would happily take that on. The one thing I wouldn't do is we were looking at LaVita had their system. I was looking at it with Steve Bell, and it's got a little clamp on it. And Steve's like, oh, he puts his thumb on it. And he had the thing clamp on the flesh between his thumb and his forefinger. And it didn't hurt that bad, but I'm like, I'm not doing that. Like, not for journalism. Like, that looks like that might be pinchy. Yeah, I don't want to do that. But I'll swallow a pill cam, sure. Yeah, that's no problem at all. But, all right. Well.
Good
times. Good to be back in Boston. And so next week, we won't have Newmarkers Newsmakers, but we'll be back the week after with that. And, all right, let's get the rest of the podcast started.
Happy July 4th, everybody.
All right, I'm very happy to bring you our keynote conversation brought to you by Freudenberg Medical. We're going to hear from Dr. Janar Sathananan. He is Chief Medical Officer at Boston Scientific's Interventional Cardiology Therapies Unit. Let's listen. Well, Janar Sathananan, welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to, I'm eager to hear more about the agent drug-coated balloon. It's a space that I know a little bit of, just sort of in references, but never really got a good explanation as to how it works and why it's important. So I'm looking forward to getting those details. But as always, we'd love to find out about our guests first. Did you find your way into medicine? And then after that, I'd like to talk about your transition to industry. So what drew you to be a doctor?
Yeah, it was a little bit of a personal journey for me, I would say, Tom. I mean, when I was in high school, I had a fixation that I was going to be an engineer. But when I was 15 years old, my father, at the age of 48, had a heart attack.
Oh, my.
When I was growing up in New Zealand. And it was a little bit of a surprise for me. I'd not really experienced illness in somebody that was close to my family before, and certainly for my father, I've never seen that. And that was certainly a shock to me, because he was always like my role model. And to see it, it really resonated to me that, you know, health can really affect anybody, no matter how prominent they are or how strong they seem to be. And so he had a heart attack, and he actually got one of the very first drug-eluting stents in New Zealand, which was just in the first year of its release at that time. And, you know, ironically, it was actually a Texas stent, which was a Boston Scientific product, which I didn't know at the time, obviously. But I found out many, many years later when he showed me his PCI report, or his stenting report, in late terms.
Was this prior to your joining Boston Scientific, or after joining?
It was just before I joined.
That's interesting.
I would say about a year or so before I joined, he just happened to pull it out from a drawer and show it to me. And so it's something about that just sort of resonated in my memory, because obviously at that point I was already an interventional cardiologist. And so I was looking at stent brands and what he had treated, et cetera.
Interesting. That's fascinating. Interesting. The universe has an interesting sense of humor sometimes. So, did you shift right there and then from wanting to be an engineer to a doctor, or how did that transition occur?
I was pretty, from that day on, I was a little bit more concrete on becoming a physician from there on in. And, you know, the system in New Zealand is that you go straight from high school into medical school. So I graduated from medical school when I was 23, so I had very little life experience, but you get thrown into the deep end of caring for patients. But it's just a different system compared to North America, and there's other regions in the world that do it the same way. But I wasn't necessarily attuned to being a interventional cardiologist from that early age, just because my father had a heart attack. I was actually pretty fixated on becoming an orthopedic surgeon for the longest time through my medical school training. But that sort of shifted around my fifth year of medical school.
What was the catalyst? What drew you into that, other than your father's, whether it played a factor or not, but your father did have that history.
Yeah. So there was another second kind of point in my life where you sort of mentioned, Tom, that life has a certain kind of irony to it at times. It was my second brush, I guess, with Boston Scientific in some peripheral way, because I, you know, in medical school training, you can do these little electives, right? You can go for a month or so. And so I went to Melbourne I just wanted to live in the city for a month. So I just picked anything that was available. And so I picked interventional cardiology. And so I turn up to the cath lab on the very first day. And actually, the very first person to show me and talk me through a coronary angiogram was Ian Meredith, Professor Meredith. So obviously, you know, he worked for Boston Scientific before I did. And so it was actually his kind of my exposure to him and his mentorship during that time, and I went back and did more research with him, that it kind of, that was kind of like a light bulb moment for me that attracted me to interventional cardiology. It was this perfect kind of combination of technical hands-on skill, science, and new devices and technology. And those have always been the three facets that have attracted me to the specialty. And so from that day on, I was dead set on not only being a cardiologist, I only wanted to be an interventional cardiologist.
That's fascinating. Yeah, looking back, sort of dissecting this, I would see the your interest in engineering and cardiology being that being a natural intersection of the two. Does that play out? I mean, is it a does this feed your love of gadgetry and how things work and actually fixing things? Does it feed that part of your soul?
Oh, for sure. I mean, I think all interventional cardiologists to some degree have some love for the toys, as it's colloquially called. You know, that was certainly a very strong trait for me. It resonated during my research career. I spent quite a bit of time doing translational research, which was really bench-related research. So in the structural space, so basically dissecting, you know, the components of a valve, trying to understand how it would fit into different types of patients and scenarios. So it was really just an opportunity to be a wannabe engineer, because I don't have any of the skill sets, but, you know, it's fun to play around with these gadgets.
What was the time frame? I mean, I'm seeing you sort of entering this field, maybe not as its emergence. I mean, you mentioned the your father's heart attack happened with the first drug-eluting stents. And I guess that for me is kind of the liftoff point, but this is, you've probably joined as a rocket ship was ascending in this specialty.
Yeah, I would say that my career path was not necessarily at the, I mean, it was very much in the upward and very forward momentum of drug-eluting stents. But by the time I was sort of really getting into the meat of my interventional training, it was a fairly established space. What was really emerging was structural heart interventions. And so that was very much a growing phase at that point. But we've seen an evolution in the coronary space certainly in the last 5 to 10 years. And so I think there's certainly renewed interest in that space moving forward. But it's, I think that's one of the really nice things about interventional cardiology for me, is that there's always so many areas that people are pushing the envelope with regards to science and also with regards to device innovation. I mean, if you think all the things that people are doing with regards to heart failure interventions, LV modification, you know, there's a whole plethora of devices in the structural intervention. It's really fascinating just the level of ingenuity in the space. And that's why it's always very exciting. So I don't see that slowing down in any shape or form, which is really exciting.
Oh, that's fascinating. Yeah, no, I was watching the video, the marketing video you have for the drug-coated balloon, and just the process of going with IVUS and kind of scanning and exploring, it reminded me of like a space mission, you know, just this like this very, very cool technical exploration of the body. So I could see how that could certainly keep your interest over time. How then, when did this path toward Boston Scientific sort of become complete? It seemed like you were through interactions and in incidental contact, you were kind of inching toward a relationship with Boston Scientific, but what ultimately happened? And maybe you weren't, but I'll just
yeah, it's a good question, Tom. It's one I thought about for a long time, because if I'm being honest, I had not really seriously considered a role in industry. I had certainly thought, I had involvement and I was very much attracted to the startup space within the medtech arena. But I hadn't really considered a role in industry seriously until the offer came. And so firstly, it was a privilege to be considered for such a role like this, which really gives you such a unique insight into how medicine is delivered. And so ultimately, I really went for it because it's such a unique position. These kind of offers may be a once-in-a-lifetime kind of offer that crosses your desk, so to speak. But also, I think I have to say, subjectively, I maybe believe a little bit in some of these signs. And so, you know, my two prior contacts with sort of, or brushes, I would say, with Boston Scientific kind of, I think, played a subjective role for me, at least emotionally, in making the decision.
That's fascinating. No, and we Boston Scientific and others always talk about the impact on the patient that their devices have and that health has. And you're an example also of just the way that it impacts families and the way it can change directions of lives. So it's really a important undertaking. So are you still practicing at all?
So I still am practicing. I practice in Vancouver, Canada. So I practice a week a month. So I really enjoy being in clinical care and being in the cath lab. And so I'm fortunate that I'm able to continue that on. Just to finish the last question, Tom, there's one other aspect that I haven't actually told anyone before about why I wanted to join Boston Scientific in particular, but I have a little bit of a sort of side interest in the history of interventional cardiology. So I love reading old stories about and watching really old interviews from early people that founded the way. And, you know, the company in particular, back in the days when it was SciMed and, you know, with the original founders, they had so many brushes with people like Andreas Grinzig. And so it's really a company that has been through the initial start of the specialty. And so that aspect of it is a pretty unique opportunity as well. And that factored into my decision-making as well.
Oh, that's fantastic. So let's move from that history to where we are today. Talk about the sort of coronary artery disease, and sort of its frequency today, the state of it today, and let's talk a little bit about the state of stenting. I mean, this is, as we've alluded to a few times, it's been around for decades. I think it's been such an important driver for the medtech industry to really keep, especially in the 90s when it sort of ignited a lot of the interventional opportunities moving into other specialties as well. But where are we today with coronary artery disease and stenting?
Yeah, so first of all, coronary artery disease is an extremely common problem that still exists to this day, right? It is not a problem that's going away for patients, for people's families, for people that they know. I'm sure anyone that you meet has had a brush or contact with somebody that has been affected by coronary artery disease in some shape or form. And that's reflected by people really know in the community what a heart attack is. I would say that what has changed, if you look across the globe, it's a little bit different as what happens in developed countries like North America versus the rest of the world, right? If the burden of or number of percutaneous coronary interventions or simplistically stenting procedures is not necessarily growing a tremendous amount if we look at trends based on the data. However, patients are living longer. There's longer life expectancy. We have lots of great medical therapies that are contributing to that increase in life expectancy. However, that being said, what it means is that there is quite an increase with regards to the complexity of coronary artery disease that is being treated in the stenting space. So ultimately, you know, simple interventions are becoming less common and more complex interventions are increasing in their frequency. And so certainly what it means from a treatment perspective is that it's really important to have and as a clinician, a comprehensive toolkit with regards to being able to treat and manage these patients. And for example, one thing that adds to complexity of coronary artery disease is calcium therapy. But there's also other areas where you can have stents, and stents may fail and come back. And that's in particular where AGENT has a particular role in those kind of interventions, because it's not only the first intervention we're talking about that may be complex, it's also subsequent repeat interventions that patients come back for due to the occurrence of some failure of their stent.
All right, we'll take a quick break from this conversation to bring back our sponsor, Freudenberg Medical. Once again, I am speaking with Julia Calbit. She is Business Development Director for Drug Devices at Hemotech, which is a company of Freudenberg's. Julia, I understand that Freudenberg Medical and Hemotech made a big announcement last couple of weeks. Can you fill us in? Tell us a bit more.
Yes, we recently announced a major expansion for our drug device business with a groundbreaking ceremony for a second facility in Aachen in Germany. We are investing over $50 million in this new site to meet the increasing demand from our customers for drug coating solutions for balloon catheters and stents. With this investment, we are establishing a new 130,000 square feet facility that will triple our existing footprint for drug device solutions. Additionally, we plan to hire another 150 employees, thereby increasing our total existing workforce by a half. The new site will significantly expand our current clean room capacity and add new state-of-the-art chemistry labs for our R&D team. So it's very exciting for us, and we are looking forward to the future journey with our customers as we accelerate our work to bring new and innovative device solutions to the market.
Wow, that is exciting. Julia, so we're hearing a lot about combination products, drug device solutions. They offer enormous potential for therapeutic benefits, for better patient outcomes. This must be an exciting time to be in this space. When you look across this category of minimally invasive devices, what are the future innovations that excite you most?
I am most excited about innovations in drug-coated balloons. We are currently witnessing exponential growth in the drug-coated balloons market, driven by the Leave Nothing Behind principle, which offers significant benefits and reduces risks for patients. We see that drug-coated balloons and drug-eluting stents are now increasingly competing, and there are numerous trials showing that drug-coated balloons can be favored for specific patient subgroups. I'm also interested in the ongoing debate between the drugs paclitaxel and Lymus for drug-coated balloons. This is especially intriguing as we work with both. First head-to-head trials indicate comparable clinical outcomes for both drug classes, although these comparisons focus on primary endpoints so far. As larger randomized trials and long-term studies are conducted, we'll gain more valuable insights. At Farnbeck Medical and Hemotech, we are very excited to accelerate further innovations for our customers, supporting them with unique capabilities and expanded capacity.
Wow, it's a great time to be in this industry. Julia, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you very much for this nice interview. It's been a pleasure.
All right, once again, thank you to Freudenberg Medical for sponsoring this episode of the Device Talks Weekly Podcast. If you'd like to find out more information about Freudenberg Medical, go to its website, freudenbergmedical.com. That's FreudenbergMedical.com. So are patients overall, is the average age of a patient, is it higher than it's been? Are you treating older patients or are you working downward and finding patients as young as your father who are getting treated? Where is the median age sort of settling right now?
Yeah, I think it's you still get those young patients in their 40s and 50s, you know, that come in with acute heart attacks and ST elevation, myocardial infarctions, where the artery is completely blocked and needs to be opened up. But you also get just heart attacks of various other descriptions that come in. There is certainly and what's happened over time is that we also have a lower threshold to treat patients that are older now. And that's because patients that are older are not necessarily wanting to be left untreated, right? They want to maintain a good quality of life. They want to be able to go out and walk with their grandkids. And so there is certainly a lower threshold to treat those older patients. So I'd say overall, we're seeing older and more complex patients, you could say.
Mm-hmm. And are they, talk a bit about the treatments available to them in the forms. Let's talk about the stents first. They have been evolving, Boston Scientific and others, with the disease, but what are they capable of doing today, the stents that perhaps they weren't 10 years ago? And how is their performance overall changed over time?
Yeah, so stents are pretty good, right now. They do a fantastic job in terms of their treatment. It's been decades of evolution in terms of technology to get them to where they are now. Very simplistically, a stent is nothing more than just a scaffold that basically scaffolds the artery. So if you have a narrowing, you basically balloon it to prep the lesion, and then you basically scaffold it to keep it open. And that's what the metallic frame of a stent is. What's evolved now is that when they had what was called as bare metal stents, which is literally just the metallic scaffold, there was a high rate of re-narrowing of those stents. But what's evolved now and what is commonplace now is what is called drug-eluting stents. So that frame has a drug coating on it that prevents that re-narrowing. That can still occur, of course, but that's reduced that dramatically. And so it's a very established therapy right now, and the performance is very good with stents.
So let's talk a bit about the agent drug-coated balloon. Where does a balloon fit in to this treatment? Is it something that's done instead of stenting, when stenting isn't an option? Describe a situation when a drug-coated balloon is necessary.
Yeah, so I'll do it in the context of what we looked at with regards to the agent IDE study, because it really reflects the clinical scenario that people wanted to use the device for the most in the United States. But I will remind the audience as well that the device and therapy with drug-coated balloons has been available globally outside of the United States for well over a decade. It's a very established treatment. But to answer your question specifically about the scenario where it may be used in, I'll just use a very simplistic stat in the sense that when you look at the number of interventions that are performed now, and when I say interventions, it's coronary treatment of a coronary lesion, 10% of those are due to in-stent restenosis, so re-narrowing of a prior stent. So it's a fairly common thing that needs to be treated. And the way that an agent balloon or drug-coated balloon plays a role is essentially by preventing the need to place another layer of stent inside that prior failed stent. Because we know from the data that placing multiple layers of stent is detrimental because it can only accelerate the rate of re-narrowing again in the future. So essentially all you're doing is providing a metal-free option to be able to deliver the drug to that area that's re-narrowed to prevent that from occurring again in the future.
So let's talk about the in-stent restenosis first. I mean, what is causing the growth? Are the stents sort of just covering up a crack in a foundation and a crack is forming further up the wall, or what causes the re-narrowing of the artery or the vasculature?
Yeah, there's a few different things that can cause it. So simplistically, you can think about, is the issue because you didn't place the first stent properly? Because it can be due to issues, what we call undersizing the stent or malapposition, which simply means, to keep it very simple, it basically means not all the metal components of the stent are touching the wall of the artery. And so if that would occur, that certainly can accelerate the potential for stent failure. But also due to a number of different biological factors, you can also just get re-narrowing through different biological processes that re-narrow the stent inside the metal frame. Similarly to the same kind of physiology of how the patient got a narrowing to begin with. So that's partly why in these kind of scenarios, it's strongly recommended and guideline recommended that you use intravascular imaging in order to fully understand the why this occurred before you go on to treatment. So using something like an intravascular ultrasound, for example, will tell you exactly the mechanism as to why this stent has failed. And so that can guide your treatment appropriately. from there on in.
Interesting. Are the balloons only used within a stent that's already been placed, or are they used where there hasn't been a stent used yet, but it's sort of as a primary form of treatment?
It's a great question, Tom. I will say that in the United States, in terms of what the AGENT IDE trial did, the indication is specifically approved for is treatment of a failed stent, so inside a prior deployed stent. If I can talk about what happens outside of the United States where the therapy has been around for a while, it's used in a broad range of other clinical scenarios as well. Certainly, that's been my own personal practice since I work outside of the United States, and we've had the product for over 10 years. You'll probably recall, of course, there was this enthusiasm for bioresorbable stents once upon a time. And I would say that there's a renewed enthusiasm and always has been this enthusiasm for a metal-free option. And drug-coated balloons is one alternative for a metal-free option. And so where the balloon is being used in other scenarios outside of inside stents is small vessels that have a narrowing, because the smaller you go in a vessel, the more likelihood that the stent could re-narrow. So using just a drug-coated balloon in those scenarios is used. There's also long diffuse disease where you may not want to use stent for the entire segment, that you can maybe stent a component of the vessel and then use a drug-coated balloon for the rest. And there's also interest in bifurcation lesions. And when I say bifurcation lesions, I basically mean a vessel that splits into two. Mm-hmm. And so you might stent one limb of the vessel and then use a drug-coated balloon for the other limb.
Curious, what you've spent your entire career outside the U.S. I believe you haven't practiced in the U.S., have you?
No.
So what... You must have an interesting perspective on working on a company that where the largest med tech market is the U.S. And as you said, you've been working with these for a number of years outside the U.S. How does that sort of inform your role as CMO? Just having actually had practical experience using devices, now you're able to work with physicians in the U.S. You know, you're bringing these years of experience and evidence with these devices. It must be an extraordinarily helpful perspective to be able to work on some of these devices when they're available outside the U.S., when they become available inside the U.S.
Yeah, correct. I mean, I think the first point you highlight, Tom, is that there is a real inequality in care globally, right? Or even within countries, right? In terms of availability to different technologies. It's not necessarily homogenous either across countries or even within a country across different socioeconomic groups. Now, as it relates to the agent story, you know, I wouldn't say I necessarily had a major part to play because I'm relatively new to the company, but it's a perfect example, though, of the most effective medical technologies always address a clinical need. And this was a need that was driven by patient need, but also physicians were asking for this for years and years. And the pathway to get this approved, of course, usually any cardiovascular device has a very rigorous regulatory process with the FDA. And so it did take a long time. And also it's crucial that there's good clinical data to support that. And so where you can see that enthusiasm, I think, has been in the trial enrollment within our AGENT IDE. We were able to get the study done 6 months ahead of schedule. Enrollment was very quick. And it really highlights, again, the clinical need for the device. And, you know, physicians were actually using peripheral balloons in the coronaries off-label just because they didn't have an available product. And similarly, now that we've been fortunate to be able to launch the device, there's just a tremendous clinical need for the device. And so I think the benefit of having that outside U.S. experience in this situation is we already know kind of the benefits of this device, of this type of therapy, but also where it could potentially even grow to in the United States as well in terms of our next wave of evidence.
Final couple of questions, just looking ahead. You're in a position, you're a lover of history. You've had these these serendipitous interactions with Boston Scientific throughout your life. Now you're here. You have an opportunity to write the next chapter. What does the next chapter look like for interventional cardiology, for the balloons? Where do you see these sort of therapies headed and these technologies evolving?
I think the key thing is we have to, where we focus on, and I think is really crucial to think about, is that it's not just a specific device in isolation, right? If you take AGENT, for example, it's not just the AGENT drug-coated balloon. It's essentially a totality of care for that patient when treating them. It's a combination of imaging, appropriately prepping the vessel. That may involve some calcium modification tools. And then the final treatment device that may be a drug-coated balloon or a stent. And so it's been able to provide that entire package. But I think what's really important is, from an industry perspective, we have to constantly be doing a good job to ensure that these technologies are easy to use and simplistic in terms of the information they provide, because physicians have a lot of different options. And it's important that those treatment options are simple, and because labs are busy, physicians are busy. And the most important thing is to ensure that they're safe for patients.
And we talked about technology, but what about the physicians? What does the base of interventional cardiologists look like going forward? Is this a specialty that is that has fewer physicians or is forecasted that way? And how does a company like Boston Scientific sort of respond to that?
I think what we're going to see is, I don't think we're necessarily going to see fewer physicians. We're going to see, I mean, as I said, coronary disease is not going away. I think what we're going to see is we're going to see a large change in terms of the workforce in the next 5 to 10 years. Like many medical specialties, there is an aging workforce in terms of certain specialties, and that is no different than in interventional cardiology. And so there's going to be a big shift in the next 5 to 10 years. And it's going to be crucial, I think, for us from an industry perspective to be able to continue to ensure that education of those very senior, seasoned group of individuals can be passed on and maintained. Because training and workflow is very different than it was 20, 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Now, well, this has been a very fascinating conversation. I appreciate your sharing your personal story and your professional story. And thanks for being on the podcast.
No, thank you very much for having me, Tom. I appreciate it.
All right, well, that is a wrap. Thanks again to Freudenberg Medical for sponsoring this episode of the Device Talks Weekly Podcast. You could do us a few favors if you don't mind. Please subscribe to the Device Talks Podcast Network. It'd be great to send you future MedTech stories. Please share this episode on social media. Please connect with me, connect with Chris Newmarker, connect with Sean Hooley, connect with Kayleen Brown. Make sure you follow Device Talks, Mass Device, and Medical Design and Outsourcing on social media channels. We actually put out a lot of great content, and people really enjoy it. And if you're not one of those people, well, why not? I mean, how much joy is there in life? Do you have too much? If you have too much joy, fine. But if you want a little more joy, make sure you follow us on LinkedIn and take part in some great MedTech conversations. Once again, Device Talks West is happening on October 16th and 17th. Make sure you keep an eye on the agenda for that. You can register now and get our early bird discount. And of course, Device Talks Tuesdays, the next one will be June 9th. And again, we'll have Steve Bell there giving a really great presentation that he opened up SRS. He was asked to open up SRS 2024, the Society of Surgical Robotics. And I'm sorry, the Society of Robotic Surgery. And Steve gave a very thought-provoking presentation, which led me to think that we should provoke some more thought and get it out to you in Device Talks land. So make sure you register for that. It's free. If you're watching live, ask questions. You can also watch it on demand, but we won't be able to take the questions like we typically do with a Device Talks Tuesdays. All right, folks, thanks again. Have a great holiday weekend or pre-holiday weekend. If you're taking the week off, have a wonderful vacation. And again, we'll have a Device Talks Weekly out to you probably next Wednesday. If not Wednesday, it'll come out on Friday, but I'm going to shoot to get it out on Wednesday. Take care, everybody.